A content warning, this episode of All the Best contains graphic descriptions of death and violent themes. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen.
And I'm Ryan Pemberton. Okay, Maddie, I want to send you a video. It's quite gruesome. Are you okay with that?
Can you tell me what it is before I watch it, or does that ruin the...
This is like graphic images of bodies.
Like human bodies?
Yeah.
And they're dead? Okay. All right. Yeah.
It's okay if you don't... Don't do it just for the show.
I would do anything for this show. Yeah, okay, I'll watch it. A body farm in Texas, okay.
Basically, it's a video of bodies in various stages of decomposition. So these are bodies that have been left out for forensic purposes, for scientists to study the process of decomposition.
Oh, my God. There's like human bodies in cages.
And so they will scatter the bodies across a field or in some kind of natural landscape so that they get a sense of, you know, if they find a body in a crime scene and it's been left out exposed to the elements, how long is it likely to have been there, that kind of thing.
Oh my God. Oh, that's quite bad.
It's quite a graphic video, so this isn't something we would recommend for everyone to just go and chase after.
This is Rachel Menzies. She's a psychologist studying death anxiety.
We're up to the purge, so the skin is rupturing.
Last year, Rachel and her dad, who is also a psychologist, they toured these workshops around Australia. They ran them for clinicians, giving them tools to help their clients deal with their fears around death. This video is one of those tools, what's called an exposure task.
This would be quite a kind of intense, high-level exposure task because you do see things like...
There's a lot of bugs.
Close-up shots of
maggots.
You see the body being all discolored, kind of leaking bodily fluids and that kind of thing onto the grass.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And then later on in the video, you see things like the bones being...
Cleaning them with a toothbrush. They're cleaning the bones with a toothbrush?
So once the body's decomposed, the bones being... washed and scrubbed and so on.
That was disgusting.
So it's quite graphic imagery.
That's really gross.
So we really tried to give people in the workshop a kind of full slab of different options you could do, ranging from quite mild things. So, for example, watching a kid's film with themes of death, so something like the movie Coco, to the much more intense extreme exposure tasks.
Right, okay. So you just sent me straight to the extreme. We're going to give me Coco first.
Yeah, well, I guess I know that you're not someone who's crippled with fear at the thought of your own death. And you and I have both kind of been working up to this. One of the exposure tasks that Rachel talks about is this app that you and I have both been using for the past couple of weeks.
We Croak? I love We Croak. I can't stop telling people about We Croak. I'm like, I downloaded this app. It tells me I'm going to die like 5 times a day. And everyone's like, why?
Right. So this is an app that sends you a notification 5 times a day, which says, don't forget you're going to die, along with a quote. Do you want to read one out?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. This one's pretty gnarly. The other side of the sacred is the sight of your beloved in the underworld, dripping with maggots.
Super gnarly.
It's a good one, right?
So... like, what exactly do you get out of reading something like that?
I find it really comforting. I'll be stressed out about, like, my job, right? I'll be, like, at work, doing my job, feeling like, oh, like, I'm doing a bad job, or, like, I'm never going to get this done, or, oh, what if this doesn't work out? And then We Croak will send me a notification. It'll be like, remember, you're going to die. And I'm like, oh, that's right. Like, I just feel relieved. It's nice to be taken out of the microanalysis I do every day of my own life and to be forced to think about the bigger picture. It's a good reminder.
Yeah. And this is one of the points that Rachel talks about. Like, in her work, she's looking for ways to treat people who have a debilitating fear of death. But she also believes that everyone can benefit from thinking about death more often.
I think it adds a lot of value to your life that avoidance doesn't. I think often avoidance of thinking about death robs you of that opportunity to actually reconsider your life and get the most out of it.
And for Rachel, all the thinking about death that she does in her work has helped her develop a greater appreciation for the people in her life.
You know, if you're having an argument with your partner and then you bring to mind the fact that either of the two of you could be hit by a bus tomorrow, for example, I still obviously don't want my loved ones to die, but I think instead of being kind of terrified by the fact that they're going to one day die, I instead feel this sense of gratitude, I guess. It's sort of changed for me into this sense of, you know, I actually feel incredibly lucky that they're here at all, that I even got a chance to know them, particularly for relationships. I think if we really imagined that we could lose this person at any moment, I do think it would vitally change every interaction we have.
Yeah, I do that. I've always done that. Like, I live away from my friends and family. Yeah, like every time I see my mum and I say goodbye to her, I cry most times. And it's because every time I say goodbye to my mum, I know I'm not going to see her for a while. And I think about the fact that maybe one of us might die before we get a chance to see each other again. I don't ever want someone who I love to be gone and to feel like I like didn't cherish the moments that I had with them. And I like feel like the only way to do that is to just like always be thinking about death.
Have you heard of corpse meditation?
Only in that it's the name of the episode.
So this is a meditation practice where you sit and contemplate your own body as it goes through the process of death. And it goes right from your last few breaths to, you know, your body decaying and becoming part of the earth. And the idea is just like to viscerally visualize what that process will be like when it happens and remind yourself that this is going to happen to you. Would you be open to doing something like that?
Yeah, sure. Like right now?
Yeah, let's do it. So this guided corpse meditation that you're about to hear was one of the activities from Rachel's workshops. You should absolutely follow along with the meditation instructions if you want to, unless you're driving.
Picture yourself in a natural setting, somewhere in the beauty of nature. You feel the soft, comforting earth beneath you. You can feel at total peace here, at one with your surroundings, allowing the mind to become still and silent. Feel as though your life energy is becoming weak, weaker and weaker. Each inhalation is becoming more and more difficult. You know that the time has come to leave this body and return to the source. You're feeling so weak and tired now, ready to go into that deep rest of total and complete physical release. The breath is becoming weaker and weaker. The heart rate is beginning to slow down. Now the beating of the heart stops and the mind becomes silent. Now imagine that your spirit is hovering over your lifeless body. Look down at the corpse of your body. Really look. This is your body and not somebody else's. Look at your face, now devoid of consciousness and life. Take this moment to really look at the features of your deceased body. Continue looking at your body, which at one time you had considered to be you. Watch as it undergoes all the various phases of decomposition, merging back into the elements in which it came. With the immune system now gone, bacteria begin spreading from the gut throughout the entire body, digesting the intestines and other soft tissues. Bravely continue watching as the bacteria begin digesting all the internal organs. Now the putrefaction of your corpse begins, as soft tissues are broken down into liquids, salts, and gases. The accumulation of gases from the fermentation process causes the body to bloat, primarily in the abdomen. Damaged blood cells continue leaking from disintegrated blood vessels, causing the skin to take on a marbled greenish-black appearance. As you look at the corpse of your body, bloated and discoloured, you now feel total detachment and are fully dissociated from this decomposing corpse. It is not the real you, but was only a vehicle borrowed from the earth, to which it now returns. The corpse is now a food source for not only bacteria, but microbes, insects, fungus, and scavengers, which help accelerate the process of decomposition. Maggots feed on the rotting flesh, wriggling away from the body. They then pupate and transform into adult flies, laying eggs and repeating the cycle until there is no more flesh to be consumed. Scavengers such as vultures and mammals arrive to gnaw and tear away at the limbs, scattering the various parts of the body. The soil beneath your corpse is now rich with nutrients. The grasses are now a much darker green colour than the other grasses nearby. Plant life is much more diverse around your corpse, which is now only a skeletal form with a few dried patches of skin and hair. Bacteria and the elements, such as wind, rain, and sun, have now reduced the corpse to nothing more than a few bones. You can discern little more than a skull, rib cage, and pelvic bones, with other random bones scattered out here and there. After some time, the elements reduce the skeleton to only dust, as a final storm soaks it all into the earth. Your body is now nowhere, and yet it is everywhere. Look around at the local environment. The nutrients of your body have become one with everything around you. All the flora and fauna have become nourished by the nutrients of your fully decomposed body. As you consider how the bioenergy of your physical body is now fully emerged with the plants and animals of this whole area, even the earth itself, you realize that nothing was ever gained and nothing was ever lost. Consider how the elements of your body have reunited with the elements of the earth. Consider for a moment the collective vital life force energy of the entire living planet Earth. Allow your spirit to envelop the whole planet.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. None of us can really be sure that we'll be alive tomorrow. This might be the last podcast you ever listen to. Unsurprisingly, it's about death. We have two stories reflecting on the fact that we're all going to die. In our first story, a girl takes part in a supernatural ritual at her primary school.
Communicating with ghosts is simple in theory. Dying is like stepping off a tarmac and onto foreign soil, my parents said in Mandarin. You'll be severed from your bed, from the grocery shops you know best, the people you love. No landmark in sight save the cloudy bulk of winter sky. But you're never unreachable. As a child, I went through the motions. I washed apples for my forebears, chopping them into little pieces so grandfather's yellow teeth could chew them with ease. I lit the incense at the little shrine in our living room, watching smoke seep into Ma's perm as she lowered her head and whinged about her day. "Give me strength," she beseeched, "to stop throwing rocks at the white devil who keeps spray-painting penises onto our fence." During these intimate swatches of conversation, I learned about a man I'd never met. About the way he chewed sunflower seeds after smoking his pipe, how much he loved Sudoku puzzles, the time he beat my aunt with a back scratcher because she pinched his matches. In these small moments, he became so present, I felt the imprint of his gnarled hand around my shoulder. "Thank you for our good health, our home," Ma prayed. "Thank you for blessing our daughters with band sixes in Naplan English. I wondered, why did we never ask him whether it was too hot or too cold on the other side? Did he miss earthly things like jasmine tea and mahjong? But as it was impossible for him to respond in words, all he could do was grant us endless blessings, lingering in the small nooks of our lives, undetectable. Deep down, I knew he wanted to talk to me, to know me, but the connection was faulty. He had died in Burma. His physical body was buried oceans away, his spiritual one residing on another plane entirely. Maybe that's why he couldn't talk back. We had left him behind, in every possible sense. At the far boundary of Canterville Public School was an old eucalypt we called the Everywhere Tree. Allegedly, it had caught fire once in the 19th century. Now, sooty black tendrils perpetually curled across its length, reaching, reaching. The primary schoolers performed sacraments around the tree. They gave offerings in the hope of speaking to relatives and executed convicts. The theatricality reminded me of my family traditions. The yawning hole at the center of the tree was packed with canteen food and kitchen leftovers. Neon Zupa Dupa slush, cubes of black peppered beef, nuggets. As legend goes, once your sacrifice was made, you had access to the everywhere. You could talk to any ghost across any time, interred in any far-flung land. "Did you hear anything?" I asked Kevin Rowe, who had ducked his head into the hollow before me. "Nah," he said. "But I got all cold on my neck, like someone balanced an ice cube there and it slipped down." When it was my turn, I pulled air into my lungs. I willed my body to be calm, to be open and unafraid. Above me, all I could see was an expanse of arcane, flaking black, the wood still radiating the attar of centuries-old fire. Bracing my hand against the trunk, I put my head in. The smell overwhelmed me, rotten and sludgy with an overripe, sweet edge that triggered my gag reflex. But then, the cool void of darkness began to eat everything up. The stink, the feeling of ants between my fingers, the thick layers of time and distance that I had found so oppressive. For once, I was nowhere and everywhere. With my free hand, I sprinkled in a handful of sunflower seeds. "Gong gong," I whispered, waiting and waiting.
That story was written and performed by Claire Cow, with sound design by Danny Stewart. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show and you're in Sydney or Melbourne, you should come along to one of our pitch workshops. You'll learn all about how stories for the show get made and how to craft your pitch. The workshops are happening on the 17th of March at FBI Radio in Sydney and SYN in Melbourne. You can find all of the info on our Facebook page. While on a trip to America, Devana encountered signs of death that haunted her, even when she returned home.
When I climbed out of the densely packed Central Park station, I found a dead body. The body, covered in several layers, did not move or let out light breaths like a body deep in sleep. The outlines of the body appeared to be feminine. A thick coat partially covered her face, and a pearl necklace tumbled out of it. Birds pecked at her pockmarked hand and hopped around her feet. In the background, litter spilled out of black plastic bags like ripened fruit. People passed by, oblivious of her presence. The tap of their feet created an eerie soundscape to her present position. What had happened to her? Why had she collapsed right in front of Central Park? Or had her body been placed there? Since I could find no other clues about her, I continued hesitantly through to my day. I passed through the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Rockefeller Center, Brooklyn Bridge, Brooklyn. All that time, her body continued to lie there, untouched, undisturbed, and unnoticed. I had come to America for a radio conference. The visa process had been torturous, a masterclass in institutionalized humiliation. I decided to make the most of this trip and see as much of the country as I could. After the conference ended in Manhattan, I took a taxi to Washington, D.C. "Is D.C. safe?" I asked the taxi driver as I jumped inside. He told me that it depended on the area and on luck. His nonchalance bothered me. When I arrived at the hotel, I checked into a room that smelled like linoleum and decided to hunt around for some dinner. All the restaurants had closed, so I had to look for the odd shop that might be open at 1 in the morning. When I found a Shake Shack, I bought a burger and took it back to the hotel. I felt paranoid any time a man tried to make eye contact. Is he looking at me? Why is he standing on the street all alone at this time of night? Why is he smiling at me? Why is he staring at me? Why did his stare pursue me? Why did he continue to linger on me? I should have chosen the sensible option, stayed in the hotel, fallen asleep, and then prepared for an early breakfast instead. It's not like I could fight or outrun anyone at the moment. The combination of the heat and the bus ride had completely exhausted me. With this realization, I just continued to chastise my decision as I turned the corner that led to the hotel. When my time in DC came to a close, I ordered a taxi to go to the bus station. The driver pointed to a park in front of the hotel. A young lady had been stabbed there in broad daylight 3 days before I arrived. I tried to imagine her. I pictured her leisurely sitting on a bench, eating a lunch on a summer day. I could hear birds snacking on remains that had dropped out of a bin. While the heat parched the pavement, she had opened her meticulously packed lunch. Food tasted better on beautiful summer days. She had enjoyed her lunch. When the man had stabbed her to death, her lunch had dropped to the floor, unfinished. I recollected the body at Central Park. She had lain there in the bright summer light, and people had paid absolutely no attention to her. The driver's voice disrupted my thoughts. I asked him about crime rates in the area. He mentioned the poverty-filled communities east of the Anacostia River. He pointed out that the area is safer than it used to be, but also that the concept of safety was relative. While in 1996 the number of homicides had peaked at 397, In 2012, homicides stood at 88. Since then, a rate of 100 homicides occurred every year. He questioned me about home as the car passed Washington Monument, the White House, the Smithsonian Museum, and then Capitol Hill. On the bus ride out of Washington, I pulled out my phone. A mass shooting had just broken out in El Paso, Texas. Days earlier, the shooter had posted hate speech about Mexican immigrants in America. He had then purchased an AK-47, carried it into Walmart, and killed 22 people. I looked around at the passengers in the bus. Many had headphones on, read books, or had fallen asleep. They reminded me of the passerbys in Central Park. As I read about the incident, I found an article about Helvia Martinez, an 81-year-old singer at funerals and memorials. She had been too scared to step out of her house because the shooter had targeted Latinos like her. In America, firearms kill 100 people daily, and hundreds more are injured. In fact, it was an expectation I had in the back of my mind as I handed in my visa application. Inside the bus, I felt untouchable though. Surely this could not happen here, or could it? Then another mass shooting occurred. This time in Dayton, Ohio. The lone shooter killed several victims, including his younger sister. When police in the area found him, they shot and killed him. Many victims had been in their mid-20s like me, Nicholas Kermer, 25, Thomas McNichols, 25. 23-year-old local Nikita Papillon described the inbuilt optimism that many young people like her had. "People my age, we don't think something like this is going to happen," she told Politico. "And when it happens, words can't describe it." I described the incident to the girl seated next to me. She responded by noting the lack of mass shootings in Manhattan. But the detached tone in her reassurance only troubled me further. Entry into America had been exceptionally stressful, so I felt like I had to thoroughly enjoy this trip. But the omnipresence and the normalization of violence had chipped at my initial enthusiasm. By the end of my trip, a sense of perpetual paranoia had settled in and continued to haunt me even after I returned home to Melbourne. One evening in July, after several rounds of drinks, I decided to take the train home rather than catch an Uber. When the train arrived at my stop, I took the route I took every day to get home. I passed Kohl's, various Vietnamese cafes, KFC, and crossed the street to the little road that led to my home. I looked behind me and scanned the area around me. Even at my most intoxicated, I practiced this. A hooded silhouette paced behind me. At first, I did not pay much attention to this. It's just another person, right? But I noticed that if I stopped, he paused. If I increased pace, he did the same. What did he have in his pocket? Is he carrying a gun? Is he carrying a knife? Would he harm me? A chill ran into my hands and I felt dizzy. He appeared to be closer. I could not see his face. I could not collect any details about his identity. I tried to remain calm. At the back of my mind, I remembered a study I had read. In Australia, homicides of female victims by strangers made up the smallest percentage compared to acquaintance and domestic-based homicides. But this provided next to no relief. I could see no other person on the street, and I could feel the panic build up in my body like a rain cloud about to burst. I looked behind me, I looked ahead of me. He mimicked me, he did the same things I did. As he closed the distance that separated us, I questioned my choice to take the train rather than Uber. I could have even biked to see my friends. I had a variety of options, but I had chosen the train. My senses heightened. I could hear the sound of his feet. I could feel his breath on my neck. I could smell his perfume. And then, he, upon close inspection, she casually passed me on the street. She opened the door of the house next to mine and disappeared inside. I thought about the lady I had seen outside of Central Park a couple of days ago. I realized that I never found out about the faith of her body or her story.
That story was produced by Devana Senanayake, with sound design by Talise Desiderio. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe.